Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Computer Science E7. My name is Dan Armendariz. This is Lecture 2, Software Tools and Light. But I do have to revert back a little bit because I did blab a lot last week, and we weren't able to get through all of the slides. So I thought I would just quickly go back and talk about some of the relatively simple things that I wanted to bring up last week. And the first is that is just a little bit more information about this course, specifically in this case, the similarity of the discussions that we'll have from the digital cameras, because that's what really this course is about, to film cameras. So if you're coming into this course with more of a familiarity with film cameras, maybe you used to use a film SLR and you haven't used that in a while, you should feel relatively at home. A lot of the terminology and a lot of the math and a lot of the things that made a film SLR work also applies in the digital realm as well. So a lot of the words that we'll use, a lot of the terminology you will recognize from one to the other. But about halfway through the course, I have to say the similarities will end, because that's when we start going to some of the more digital aspects of photography, and that is where we'll have to diverge a little bit from perhaps your knowledge with film cameras at the time. So a lot of the terminology that we've talked about, like the 35mm film size, this is 35mm film, and we've already compared sensor sizes in digital cameras to this exact size. And so this, again, is a way that we can tie these two ideas together. So if you are comfortable with film, don't worry, you should feel right at home here. Another thing that we'll talk about next week is ISO. So the sensitivity of a film also applies in a way to digital cameras, although it works very, very differently. They still have sort of brought this idea of ISO over to the digital realm. Now, I did go into quite a big discussion last week about what might make a photo interesting. I didn't, of course, tell you what makes a photo interesting over anything else, because it's difficult to say what makes one photo more interesting. But the idea of this is that what we want to be able to do is to, with this course, by the end of this course, all of this technical knowledge that you'll have through photography or through digital cameras specifically, the idea is that through that, you'll then be able to sort of unlock the creativity and be able to create interesting photographs. So this course, like it says in the description, is not as much of a regular or everyday sort of photography course that you might be used to, where you take a lot of photos, we critique them, and it's very, very subjective. But instead, what this is, it's a little bit more rigorous and it's a little bit more technical. And the idea is not to ignore these other subjective aspects of photography, because they are just as important, if not more, but instead just to allow you to unleash your creativity, like I said before, through the knowledge of the technical aspects. And one of the things that I'm hoping that you will do by the end of this course is that you will become much more selective about the photographs that you actually like after you take them. So when I first started taking photographs, I really enjoyed pretty much all of them, and that was certainly fine. But then after a while, you start to notice, you become a little bit more critical of yourself. And it's not uncommon, and you shouldn't feel discouraged if you take literally hundreds of photographs and select only a few, half a dozen or less, out of those, because those are the ones that are not only technically proficient, but also end up being interesting as well. And it's that sort of combination of both that will really help you with your photography. So this idea of keepers, or the actual photos that you take that you actually keep in the end, is an important one. And hopefully the percentage of keepers that you have by the end of the course will be a lot less. And that's not because your skill has gone down or because you're now less knowledgeable with the camera, but instead because you're just being more critical about your own photographs, and you will be able to be a little bit more stringent about the quality of the photographs that you expect out of yourself. And so that differentiation, I think, is certainly important. And if you need some inspiration for interesting photos, I highly recommend one particular website from Boston.com called The Big Picture. And so Boston.com has this section called The Big Picture, and what they'd have is a couple times a week, maybe two, maybe three times a week, they will post these entirely picture-based articles about various things. And usually it's current events related. Sometimes if it's a relatively slow news week, there will be something related or something kind of interesting. But there's editors that amass a whole bunch of photographs from various topics and collect them all into this one article that they post on the Big Picture. And specifically, I think there's a photo editor that does the selection from a mass collection of AP photographs and other groups of photographers around the world. And they have some really fascinating, really interesting, really great photos and captions that go along with them that describe them, that might give you not only some inspiration for your own photographs, but also to help you a little bit with this idea of this composition and of all of these lighting techniques and a lot of these things that are very, very important and interesting to photography, but we frankly are just not going to have a lot of time to discuss this in this class. So there are a few things that we can mention. This is going to be super quick and pretty much one of the few times that we will go over the subjective aspect of photography, at least in lecture, is that I am sick of people centering everything in the very center of the frame. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't do it, but I'm saying this because people do it far too often. And there exists this idea of composition called the rule of thirds that's very, very common in photography. And the idea is that you divide the photograph in thirds, either horizontally vertically, or both, and you try to align subjects or aspects within the photograph to these imaginary lines. And sometimes some cameras actually will put grid lines on the actual viewfinder to help you out with this idea. So in this photograph, for example, we can see that these red lines that go down vertically and horizontally, we can see that there's some interesting things happening at the intersections of these thirds lines. So there's someone sitting on this right third line. There's a water splash in this left third line. And although the actual boat itself is centered, and I think I have to turn down the lights just a little bit so that the image can be seen on the projector just a little bit more. So even though this image is centered by itself, some of the interesting aspects of the image are perhaps off to the side a little bit based on this rule of thirds. So this brings what could be a little bit of balance to the photograph. And there's one more thing. So besides the rule of thirds and balancing a photograph, having some balance in the composition, is this idea of drawing the eye to a particular aspect within it. And sometimes you'll do that by having some leading lines, and I'll point this out whenever there's a photograph that shows it. But you usually want to try to draw the eye to something interesting within the photograph or to the interesting aspect within the photo. And sometimes what can happen is that you will take a photograph that is of something that is actually interesting that's happening. But if you are looking at it from an artistic point of view and there's nothing drawing the eye to that, and it's just sort of left out there hanging by itself, you might actually select against that photograph just because there's nothing helping the viewer isolate and determine what is the interesting aspect of it. And in fact, I do have another one. I will link to this page here. Man, I don't know why this looks so dark. I'll have to adjust this a little bit later. There's this interesting page that I will link to from the lectures page that goes into a little bit more detail about the rule of thirds and how you can adjust your own photographs to try to follow it and get something a little bit more interesting out of what might be a otherwise relatively regular or normal photograph. So with these ideas in the back of your mind, use them to your advantage. You certainly don't have to ignore these important aspects, the subjective, the composition, all of these various things that can make a photo interesting. But I'm just trying to say that this is something that we just are not going to have a lot of time to talk about in lecture in this class. So certainly you should try to enhance your skill and develop your own style, but use this as sort of a balance or as an entry point, as a way to get started with your own style. The rule of thirds is definitely a good way to go with that. Now, one of the things about digital photography that is not quite so good is that it is actually pretty expensive. It can be costly to get a lot of accessories, to buy cameras, to buy lenses, to buy tripods, all sorts of stuff. And I'm very cognizant of this, and I'm sure you are as well. If you've come into this class and you're maybe looking into purchasing a new camera or getting yourself a new lens or something like that, it's not cheap. And I can't really help you with that, but what I can do is try to point out some of these do-it-yourself sort of tutorials that might help you with some of these projects if you have an interest in them. So one of these things, for example, is yet another link that I have where not only could you make your own pinhole camera from the link that I showed last week, but in this case, you might be interested in taking panoramic photographs. And what you can do is to actually create your own what's called panoramic head, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a little bit, but you can create your own panoramic head that will help you twist your camera in just the right way to be able to create more accurate or relatively stunning panoramic photos. Now, the idea behind this is that you can't just use a regular, well, you could, but it's much more difficult to use a regular tripod head like this to be able to twist the camera. And the problem with using a regular tripod head that's not designed for panoramics is that you will get these weird geometric distortions as you twist the lens. So if you've ever tried to take multiple photos just by standing in one spot and twisting your body, for example, and try to later stitch the photos together, you might notice that they don't line up exactly, that they're just off ever so slightly at the very edges. And this is called parallax. There's this geometric distortion that occurs whenever you swivel around a camera, and using a panoramic head is designed to minimize this. There's a specific point in the lens that you can mathematically calculate that you can actually spin the camera around and eliminate this geometric distortion. And that is what this panoramic head does. So you'll notice that this head is mounted such that the camera can actually swivel close to the end of the lens, and that is the difference. So whereas typically what you would do to take a panoramic photo is you would just sort of twist your body or twist the camera like this, maybe around the center of the camera itself, that's not technically the correct way to do it. If you want to eliminate these distortions, what you should do is find, I think, what's called the nodal point of the lens, and you twist around that instead. And using this panoramic head lets you do that. Now, the problem with this panoramic head is that if you purchase one, because you take a lot of panoramics, it is an expensive proposition. It can be hundreds of dollars to purchase a tripod head that you might use only a few times. And so part of the reason that you might want to do it yourself is to make it a little bit more accessible in terms of the cost. And there's really no reason why this wouldn't work as well, except other than, I guess, if you're taking panoramics in the rain and you had crappy wood, then the whole thing would fall apart, or use, I don't know, what have you. Maybe your skills with do-it-yourself are not quite up to par, and this will be difficult to make. That might be, you know, very solid good reasons for not being able to or not wanting to do this, but still, the option is definitely there. Now, the rest of it, though, I have to say there's not really a lot that you can do. The things are very, very expensive. Cameras are expensive, tripods are expensive, and it's difficult to get into photography for the first time, especially if you get an SLR, because you buy an SLR and it's not just the SLR, right? You have to buy a case, you have to buy a tripod, you have to buy additional lenses, all these accessories like a camera strap, what else do you need? Memory cards, all this sort of stuff that you need to actually get up and running can easily double or triple the cost of your initial expenditure. Now, there are a few things that I want to mention. If you are thinking of buying a camera, just to reiterate from last week, remember that you are not required to buy one for this course. We do have a few that you can borrow from the Church Street Lab. This is it, the Panasonic Lumix DMC FZ8, I believe it's called. And unfortunately, we only have five of these, but the way that this would work is that you go to the Church Street Lab, you tell them that you are part of this class and that you want to borrow the camera. You usually have to give them your Harvard ID. You can borrow it for 24 hours. And you might have to borrow it a couple of times if you need to actually complete an assignment and do it well, but it's certainly possible to do this class. We've done this for several years with this method, and people have been able to do it. They do also have lots of memory cards, so you don't have to bring your own. They have the chargers, all of that stuff, so you won't have to purchase a thing. Now, if you do decide, though, to purchase your own camera, or you were thinking of purchasing one and you're using this class as a reason to, you know, you're telling your significant other, oh, but I have to for class. I didn't say that, but, you know, if what you tell your significant other is none of my business. So If you're going to do that, there's two requirements that your camera must meet. First of all, it must have the full manual control over the exposure. This means you must be able to change the ISO, the shutter speed, and the f-number, or the aperture of the camera. All three of those things must be changed, and usually they're collectively called the manual mode. You can usually just look in the specifications of your camera to determine if it has this. The other thing that might be a little bit more difficult to find, especially in compact cameras, is the so-called RAW mode, where that will actually, the camera will take photos and store them on the memory card in the RAW file format. Now, most all digital SLRs can take photos in the RAW format, and some of the higher-end compact cameras can as well, but really to get through this course, you're going to need both of these features, and by the end of the course, you'll probably find yourself wanting both of these features in a camera anyway. So using both of these is not only beneficial for the class, but it'll also help you grow into the camera just a little bit. Now, one of the things that I was talking about before that I sort of waved my hand at was the idea of a tripod head. And it's important to recognize that when you start looking at tripods to purchase, they come in different parts, or they can come in different parts. They can come in just the legs, which are just, you know, the legs of the tripod itself. And sometimes you will also find that the head is a separate purchase altogether, and you have to buy both of them separately, and then you attach the head onto the legs. And that's perfectly okay if you decide to purchase something like that. The benefits of having a system that you can actually change the tripod head is that you would then be able to use different heads for different purposes. Like you saw before, the panoramic head might be useful if you take a lot of panoramic photos on your tripod, whereas you might have a ball head. This is a very typical type of head that you would see on a still camera. It's not very useful for video, but this is very useful for still because it's very easy to just put the camera where you want it, and then you can lock it with a little mechanism on this side. And this is usually the preferred setup for a lot of digital and still photographers, is to have a ball head on some very sturdy legs. Now, the problem with tripods is that they can be, so if you're looking for tripods, you usually want one that's stable, that's lightweight, and that's relatively inexpensive. The problem with tripods is that you can only pick two of the three. So you can buy one that's stable and lightweight, but it's going to be super expensive. You can buy one that is inexpensive and stable, but it's not going to be lightweight, so on and so forth. And it's all definitely a compromise. Just like many, many things in digital photography, everything is a compromise. You might buy, like what we were talking about last week, a digital SLR is fantastic for its quality, but you're compromising because it's expensive and it's relatively big and bulky and heavy. So similarly, when we're talking about tripod legs, you might get a pair that's really light and that's relatively stable, but they're not going to be cheap. And in fact, I had a second pair set of tripod legs with me last week. I didn't bring them because I was carrying way too much stuff, but they were there to show you the difference because, and unfortunately I didn't get to this last week, but there's this set which is light and compact and small, but then there's another set that was aluminum and it was heavy and it was big, but it was very, very stable and it was very inexpensive compared to these other tripod legs. So it's a game that you have to play with yourself. You have to decide which of those two features you actually want in your tripod legs to be able to when you're making this purchasing decision. Now, when I first bought my first tripod, I decided to go for stable and inexpensive because I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to really get into this photography thing for much longer, and we'll see how it goes. And that tripod is great. A lot of the photos that you will see in this class were actually taken with that tripod, and I love that tripod. It's aluminum, but the problem is that it's heavy. And I realized that several years ago, I decided to go to England for Thanksgiving. This was a last-minute decision. I bought tickets 20 hours before the plane left. So Thanksgiving Day, I rush over to the airport, I get on the plane, I go over there, and I left my tripod at home because I didn't have time and I didn't have the weight to pack it. I didn't want to check any bags. And that was the worst decision I've ever made because I went there, and it was, of course, being England at the end of November, rainy and dark, and I could take zero photos without a tripod. And so I realized at that point, okay, now I need a tripod that I can actually carry with me, that I can actually take with me on trips, that I will actually be able to pack. And that was the motivation behind purchasing this tripod. And this tripod I actually love. It's not quite as stable because it's considerably lighter. It's literally half the weight as the other set, but now I can actually pack it into, it folds small enough to actually fit into a backpack that I can take on a plane with me. And in fact, I did. Just this past January, I went to China for 2 weeks and did only carry-on bags with all of my camera equipment packaged in these carry-on bags. So it's possible to do it, and it's not easy, but it's possible to do it. And if you're going to do it, be prepared to do a lot of research, because these tripods can be inundating. There's a lot of different choices. But the end result, or the end takeaway, is that do your research and try to determine which of those two of the three things you want, whether you between inexpensive, stable, or lightweight, and go with that. And that will be a good starting point when you're looking at a tripod. And the reason that I'm focusing so much on tripods is because it is perhaps the most important purchase that you can make for your camera, for the quality of your photos, other than the camera itself. Well, and even that sort of, I would say that the tripod might even be more important than the camera itself. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that that we will talk about, of course, at a later time. Okay, now moving on, just a little bit more about classes. So we have tentatively set up these two section times. So remember from last week I said that we will have two optional sections. You can attend one or both weekly. We have Mondays from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the 53 Church Street, room 201, or Tuesdays from 7:35 to 9:35 after lecture at 51 Brattle Street, and the room number, and I know this looks confusing, it's not a mistake, the room number is actually called 123/5. So I think it used to be two rooms that was then made later into one room, so it's not either or, that is the room number there. Now we're not going to start sections until next Tuesday, a week from today. So don't bother going today after class or on Monday, because that won't happen. And this might change. We've been having some fluctuation in enrollment. Our TFs might change. So we will see the quantity of TFs that we have might change. So we will determine probably by next week what the final schedule is. But at least for now, you can plan for next Tuesday as the start of your sections. Now, one last thing that I want to mention, we will be posting, of course, the videos from each lecture on the course website. This first time, it takes us a little bit longer to get everything set up. Hopefully, subsequent ones will take a little bit less time, but it could still take several days after lecture has occurred for us to actually post the video on the course website. You can go to the course website /lectures to find all of those. Let's see, so the course website lectures here, and we have downloads for you. You can download the audio, or you can download an MP4 file that you can put onto your iPod or your iPhone, or you can even stream it live over the internet, a la YouTube. It's not YouTube, but you can watch an hour and 45-minute lecture on your computer via this webpage here. Now, there are two exceptions. There are two lectures that we are not going to videotape, and those are the lectures that deal with the assignment slideshows. So assignment slideshow. So this lecture on October 19th, it's assignment slideshow and movie night. We will not be filming that one. And the second assignment slideshow, we will not be filming either, November 30th, the last class of the semester. So for those two, we certainly recommend that you come and enjoy the class, because we will be going over some of the fantastic photos that you will be taking for the assignments and for this class, and discussing them in a fun and interesting way. At least I hope it'll be fun and interesting. Okay, now on to some of the meat of today's lecture. So a lot of digital photography is very interesting and very, we will put a lot of emphasis on the actually taking pictures part of photography. And this is the part that I enjoy the most, is going out there and taking photos and looking at them on the camera, chimping a little bit to see what they look like. But there is the other very important side of photography as well, and especially as it relates to digital photography, and that is post-processing the photo. So after you've taken the photo, you can't just leave it on your camera. You generally want to or have to do something with it, whether it is to download this photo off of your camera, put it on your computer, and send it to Flickr so that you can submit it as part of an E7 assignment, or whether you really like the photo. You want to download it, modify it a little bit, post it on Flickr, and send it to your friends and family so that you can show how great of a photographer you are becoming. In either of these cases, or others as well, you have to use some additional software tools in order to be able to accomplish any of these things. Now, the software, there's a myriad of options for software in terms of digital photography, but typically these come in different classes, and a lot of products can fall under more than one class of digital software. And so we might have, for example, photo organizers. So if you're familiar with iPhoto, for example, that is a photo organizer where it downloads your photos and it organizes them into events or albums or whatever sort of usual construct they want to call it. There's also raw processing. So for example, Phase One up here is the name of a company that creates a product that's called Capture One, and that is primarily a raw processor where you download a raw file off of your camera, you use that program or you use that software to modify it. Adobe Photoshop also includes a sort of a plugin that's called Adobe Camera Raw, and that is a raw processor as well. iView Media Pro, that does a variety of things, but it also does raw processing. Is that true? No, it does not do raw processing. And Aperture up top also does some raw processing as well. Now, there's yet another class of software, and that is image retouching. So you've actually downloaded the file, you've processed it from its original raw type, and you want to do some editing with it. Now, the most common one that we might be familiar with is, of course, Photoshop for that. And that is, it's a very typical thing that we might see when we're modifying a photo is to use Photoshop for it. But like I said, a lot of the software available is a combination of these. Photoshop does both raw processing and image manipulation. You might even argue that it includes Adobe Bridge, which helps you with organization. Phase One is just a raw processor. Maybe in later versions they also do some very basic organization as well. iView Media Pro is basically just only organization, and Aperture does both organization, raw processing, and a little bit now with the latest version of image retouching. And I'm sure there's many, many more software tools that are available, but these are the ones that I have used, and that is the reason that these are up there. Nowadays, I don't use iView Media Pro anymore. I don't use Phase One anymore. I just use Aperture and Photoshop. But another one that you might consider, especially if you are on Windows, is Adobe Lightroom. Adobe Lightroom is Adobe's answer to Apple's Aperture software that is designed mostly to help you with raw processing and organization. And a lot of people really like Lightroom. I just don't use it. I prefer Aperture, and I use that one for my own organization. Now, photo organization is, at first glance, sort of a boring topic, but it is actually, when we start talking about it on a deeper level, a lot more interesting. And the reason for that is that it can become really horrendous to organize a whole bunch of photos. So, for example, if you did something like this, where you have a file folder hierarchy such that you just have a whole bunch of folders on your hard drive and you just download all of your photos there and use that as an organizational tool, that's certainly fine. That's easy to maintain. It's portable. You can copy it from one computer to another. There's no expensive software required. You don't have to buy Lightroom or Aperture or any of these expensive other pieces of software. And it's cheap as a result. But the downside is that it can become difficult. It can become very messy very, very quickly. If you are lax in your organization, it can become a mess to be able to do this. And it can also be tough to search. If you have thousands of images, you don't know exactly where it is, the one that you're thinking of, you will have a hard time looking for it because there is no concept of metadata. And so this idea of metadata brings us to some software that allows us to tag photos. So in the similar way that we can upload a photo to Flickr and append some tags to it, and these tags might be something that describe a little bit about the photo itself. So for example, maybe I have a scene of a landscape scene. I might call it a landscape scene. I might apply a tag that's a sunset because it's at sunset. Maybe there's a specific lake involved. So I could, like Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire, for example, so I could give a tag to that as well, just to apply some metadata so that this image would be easier to find at a later date. And so I used for a long time this program called iView Media Pro, which basically just puts all of your photos into one very long list. And this is an older version of iView Media Pro, but at the time, now I believe it's bought by Microsoft, and I have no idea what's happened to it since then. But at the time, it would just show you all of your photos in one horrendously long list, and it was up to you to apply the proper metadata. Now, the upside is that you could apply a lot of metadata to each image and be able to find images very, very quickly. The downside was that it took a long time to apply this metadata to every image. And usually, this is not something that's going to scale well. If you take a lot of images, you don't want to necessarily apply metadata to every single one, because maybe some of them you just don't care about. You're not really going to see them ever again. So some of the newer photo organizers that have come out, like Aperture and Lightroom, use a slightly different method. Although they still allow you to apply metadata and tags and keywords and all of these ideas to the photo, it combines that idea in addition to the file folder hierarchy idea, so that you can have sort of the best of both worlds, so that you can have a set of files and folders on for example, on this far left side, and organize them maybe by year or by event or what have you. And then for specific photos, you can then apply additional metadata. Maybe this one, for example, we might apply some tags like rafting and splash and water, you know, a variety of tags like that, that might make this image easier for us to find at a later date. Now, the most recent workflow that I use, and I'm mentioning this to you because it took me a long time to figure out a method that I liked, and for some of you, maybe you will have a different method, but in case it's better for you, I will tell you what I use, and maybe you will adopt it, and maybe you won't. But what I do is I use this concept of folders and projects and divide them down into these different folders. So for example, jobs, personal, places, things and projects, trips, and work. So work and trips, hopefully that's pretty obvious. So the photo that I took for this class would fall under work because I consider this a job. So I would put, I'd create an E7 project under work. I would put my photo in there and I'd be done with it. I would know where to find it at a later date. Trips is also pretty obvious. And usually this is the one that gets filled up the quickest for me, is that anytime I leave, I take a special trip somewhere that's not very common for me, maybe this trip to London or maybe this trip to China, then I will put it in there, in under this trips folder. Now, things and projects, that's pretty generic. It's pretty miscellaneous and for a reason. Usually this is something like if I'm trying to take a series of photos of the moon, for example, and it doesn't really fall under anything else, then that might be a good project, or that might be a good thing project that I can insert into that. Places, that's something that's more local than trips. So I consider these places that I live. So for example, the Boston-Cambridge area. And I would place things under places in that context. So something that is not a separate trip, I would place under there. Personal is just whatever I have that I've taken. So maybe some self-portraits or maybe some photos of my car, for example, or pets or what have you, would go under personal. And jobs is separate from work, in that it is specifically like a contracted photo job. So somebody pays me to cover an event, then it would go under jobs rather than work, because work is more of a long-term sort of thing and jobs is just meant to be shorter term. And so again, this is what I use, and I found this to be the most scalable and the best for me, but it may not be for you. But I'm just providing this as one possible solution for organizing all of your photos. Now, another thing that's interesting and neat about these newer photo organization software packages that have come out is this concept of rating. You can rate your photos from maybe 0 to 5 stars. And at first, this was a nightmare because you're rating all of your photos and it's just not going to be a very scalable solution. So what I would propose, if you take a lot of photos, is to do something like this. So you first download all of your photos to your computer, and you might have 1,000 photos in your folder. And I say 1,000, some of you are looking at me with shock, but I'm sure eventually, maybe you will take a trip that's like a week or 2 weeks, you will take eventually 1,000 photos, and you will have to get through them, and you will curse yourself under your breath for not hiring a photo editor like I do every time I have 1,000 photos that I have to get through. But you can get through them relatively quickly by using this idea of ratings and a separate concept called stacks. So stacks is yet another organizational tool where you can combine, or you can tell the software that two or more photos are related, and you would stack them together. So if you take a lot of photos that are almost exactly the same, they're only differentiated by maybe tenths of a second or just by a very small amount. As an example, you might see, these two photos here that look very, very similar. These two photos belong together, so I might stack them together because they are related. So I really only have to look at this photo this collection of photos that I really would consider to be one photo, or all to be related to each other. I only have to see it one time. So I might then stack these two photos together and give the stack a rating. I might pick which of these photos is the best and give that a particular rating. Now, when you go through your photos for the first time, I recommend that you just quickly go through. Don't edit photos as you start organizing them. That will make this process even longer. But instead, just start going through them, stacking together related photos, and as you go through them, just rate them either 3 stars, 2 star, or 1 star. Now, what I use is if I rate a photo 3 stars, that means that it has potential. It's not a terrible photo. It's not out of focus. There's no technical problems from it. There's no, you know, it has some potential. Maybe it needs a little bit of work. And I can do that a little bit later, but that's what 3 stars is for. That's basically a flag to myself that says, okay, this photo is kind of interesting. Maybe I can do something with it. Come back and look at it at a later time. Now, for photos that have problems to them, maybe there's a photo that's ever so slightly out of focus. Maybe there's a photo that's just ever so slightly miscomposed, and it's just not very interesting. I would give it either 2 or 1 stars, and that would be it. I would not look at that photo again. And usually, going through all of your photos and with this first pass, you can condense your 1,000 photos down to just a couple hundreds, maybe just 100 or just 200 photos that you can then look at with a little bit more rigor. And these photos, you would only look at the 3-star photos that you really want to, that you have determined are actually worthwhile in spending a little bit more time in investigating or in editing to try to make them the best photos that they possibly can be. So, and this is why I'm saying not to start editing all of the photos off the bat, just because that takes so much extra time, and maybe a lot of these photos are just dead ends anyway. So just be picky with yourself and narrow down your huge collection of photos using ratings and stacks down to a much more manageable collection. And then from there, you can start to do a little bit of light editing and narrow it down even further to 4 and even 5-star photos. And again, this is something that I found that lets me get through 1,000 photos relatively quickly, whereas before it was just too difficult. It was too much of a nightmare to be able to do all in one sitting. Now, keywords, this is the same concept as tags, and you might apply keywords to a variety of photos for a variety of reasons. I find that nowadays I typically don't put keywords on photos unless I actually upload them. So I don't bother putting keywords or metadata on any photos that are 3 stars or under, because those typically will not be posted on the internet. Really, what I want to do is find the photos when I've edited them, I've said, okay, these are the best photos of the collection. Those are the ones that I'm most likely to come back to, and so those are the ones that I will apply keywords and metadata to. For 2 reasons. One, for when I upload them to the internet, they'll be easily searchable in Flickr, and 2, that I will be able to find them easily within my own software as well. So don't bother, I think, with keywords until you're at the very last stage, after you've edited all the photos and you're ready to post them online. And so you have a whole bunch of ideas or concepts that you might want to battle with for your keywords. Are there any people in the photos? Are there any places? Are there any specific or interesting things that you want to mention? All of these are valid keywords. But there is one exception to that, and that is this places idea. We can actually embed within the photograph in what's called the EXIF metadata, we can actually embed the latitude and longitude and the altitude, I'm not sure, maybe the altitude of where the photo was taken in the image itself. And on Flickr, you will actually be able to see where this photo was actually taken. Will I be able to show this in time? Let's see. Oops. All right, so for example, the pinhole photo from last week, and again, the contrast is way off, so ignore it. Here we can see that there's a map on the right side, and that is because this has embedded within it the latitude and longitude coordinates of this particular image, and we can see where this photo was taken. Now, I don't think that this is a good thing to apply to all of your photos. If you take a lot of photos of your cat, for example, and you like to post them online, it's probably not a good idea to post this because then everybody will know the location of your house or of your friend's house. But this is interesting, especially for travel photos, where you can say, okay, now I have a map that shows all of these photos from around the world, and you can see little markers from where each one was taken. I think that's a compelling and interesting thing. But do take privacy and your own security into account when you're posting something like this, because it could be a bit of a concern in terms of both of those things. Okay, but this GPS metadata can be posted into something called the EXIF metadata portion of the image. And this EXIF data stores a whole bunch of information about the image itself. And usually, or always, this information is put into this file by your camera. So we can see a whole bunch of information here that my camera inserted into this particular photo. So we can see not only what type of camera it was, but we can also determine the camera's model. We can find out how big the picture is, all of the exposure settings that were used. So this was using a shutter speed of 1/2500th of a second at f5.6. We can see that it is using, a specific color space and aspect ratio. We can find the ISO, even the focal length, so how far zoomed in or zoomed out I was to take this particular image. And this is all interesting and useful information. Now, you might say, well, why would you want to know the focal length? Well, I will counteract that with a very nerdy response, and that is that when I first bought a camera, I had two lenses. I had a 50 millimeter prime, and I would actually recommend a 50 millimeter prime as one of your first lenses, just because they're just so darn inexpensive to buy, and they're also very light, and they're very inexpensive. They're not difficult to make in terms of from a camera manufacturer's point of view, so they're relatively high quality, and they also have very, very large aperture, which means that they let in tons of light, a lot more light than what you would find in, say, a zoom lens or others. And we'll talk more about the reasons for that, of course, at a later date. But the 50 prime, and people sometimes call it the nifty 50, for that reason, is that it's a pretty good purchase firsthand, especially if you are going to be taking a lot of indoor photos in low light. It's a good way to go. Now, there's caveats to that, of course, but it's a good first lens, I think. Now, another lens that I had was just a regular, just a normal zoom lens. It just went from a regular range from zoomed out, kind of zoomed out, to pretty zoomed in. You know, that's how I would describe it without going into numbers. And I wanted to buy another lens. And I was really eyeing a specific type of lens called the 70-200, and I was like, oh man, this lens looks fantastic. I really should get one of those. But what I did was I wrote a little script that analyzed all of the EXIF data of all of the photos that I'd taken up until that point and made a graph of the focal lengths that I used. And I could see that the vast majority of photos that I was taking was at the widest zoomed out setting that I could with that zoom lens. That told me, okay, maybe I should get a wide angle lens instead, because that is where I'm concentrating the majority of my photos. And so that helped me make a decision about my next purchase for the camera, just by analyzing some of the data that was here. And you don't have to be so hardcore as to write a program or a script to actually determine this. You could actually use a lot of the search functions within these newer photo organizers to help you do that. You could say, I want to find all of the photos that have a focal length of 28 millimeters, for example, and it would show you so many photos. And then you could say, okay, that's all the way zoomed out. Now, what about for the all the way zoomed in, which is 105 millimeters, I could do a search for that as well, and you would be able to compare the difference between the two. So this is definitely very useful information, and in fact, this information is what tells us a lot about how you will take your photos, or how you have taken your photos, rather, for this class. So when you take photos for this class, you'll upload them to Flickr, and you'll add them to the group, and what we do is we actually have a little program that analyzes all of this data here and determines whether or not you did the assignment correctly, just based on the numbers that have been embedded here. Now, we also look at them directly. Don't worry, we don't rely on computers to grade your assignments, but it's just a tool to help us out so that we know what you were trying to do with these particular settings. Now, obviously, these settings don't tell you everything about the photo itself. Like, you have no idea what this photo is about, but it's useful. It's useful as not only a pedagogical tool, but also as a tool for yourself to go back and say, okay, well, I know that I try to take this type of photo with these settings that I find here in the EXIF data, but it didn't really work. And why is that? And using that question and using the settings that you find here, you'll be able to modify how you take these photos to try to take better ones, at least in terms of the technical aspect of it. So this EXIF data really makes a lot easier something that in the film days we had to write down with pen and paper. So how many of you learned how to take photos on film, used a super old camera that has no autofocus, no auto anything, and what you had to do was that when every time you took a photo, and this is how I learned, and it was painful, every time you took a photo, you bust out with pen and paper and you write down the settings that you used because you had no idea of knowing. You know, there's it could be days before you get those photos back and realize, oh, shoot, I don't know why this one is too dark. I don't know what I did wrong until you look at your notepad to try to determine what settings you use. This alone makes digital worthwhile, I think, because especially when you're learning photography, this really helps out with a lot of this data. Yes?
Mm-hmm. How much of that?
So if you're using an old manual lens with a new digital camera, that lens may not be transferring data back to the camera, so you may not be able to find out, for example, the F number of the photo. So some of these things you may not be able to know. Like the focal length, you may not know what the focal length of the photo was. You may not know what the the aperture up here, the F number, F5.6, you may not know that either. And sometimes there's additional information. Sometimes the camera will also report how far it thinks the subject was when it focused on something. That information will be missing as well. But you could, you would have to kind of revert back to the pen and paper method in that case. But it is fun, I think, to use these older lenses like that as well, especially with Nikon. This is something that you would typically find on Nikon cameras and not so much with Canon, that you can use really, really old lenses on the Nikon system that goes way back to, I think, probably the 60s or so. You can get these fantastic old school lenses and use them. You just don't have, you know, autofocus, and you don't have the automatic selection of the aperture, but, you know, that's okay. It's sort of a neat thing anyway. Did I see a hand go up? Okay. Now, just to show you an example, I have this photo here, and I know it's going to be too dark because I'm getting annoyed by the contrast here, but we can take a look at this EXIF information to try to determine some information about this particular photo. So, usually in most times when you are looking at a photo, for example, this is the preview application in Mac OS, if you hit the Apple button and the letter I, it will bring up this information panel that tells you a little bit more about it. You'll have to look, depending on what software you're using, to find this information, but usually there's a little info panel that will tell you a whole bunch of information about the photo itself. So here we can see some general information. This isn't too interesting. This tells us a color profile that we'll learn about at a later date. This tells you the size of the image itself. But what's more interesting is this EXIF data. So we can see, for example, we can find out the exposure mode. So I used manual exposure to take this photo. We can find out how long of an exposure it was. It took 30 seconds. We can find out, that the flash did not fire for this one. What other values do we have? We can see the white balance here. There's just a whole bunch of information. Oh, the ISO is up here. ISO speed ratings, a whole bunch of information about this particular image that would tell you, that would give you a hint about how this photo was taken. Let's see, and do I see? So an aperture value, this doesn't look very accurate for some reason, but it says 6.6. I'm pretty sure I used an aperture of, oh no, here it is, F number 10. So it was using an F number of 10 for this particular photo. And there's additional data as well, like this GPS data, for example, that tells us where this photo was taken. And it was taken over here on what's called Raton Pass, between on I-25 between the New Mexico and Colorado border. So it was taken relatively high up in elevation, and you can see exactly where this photo was taken, which is pretty neat. And all of this data is embedded sort of invisibly, but within the file within this image file itself, there is this collection of metadata. And sometimes, now for this class, you will definitely need to keep this metadata embedded. So if you were using some software and for some reason the software is asking you if you want to remove or strip the EXIF data or strip the metadata, don't do that for this class. We need this metadata to be able to accurately grade and look at your pictures so that we can see, okay, you used these settings and you got this result. Maybe you can try something a little bit different like this. That helps us not only in the grading, but also in the commenting, in the replies that we give for you. So keep this EXIF data. Don't allow your program to strip this data when you're exporting it and bringing it into Flickr. Now, for other times, for other instances, you might have to make a decision on your own. Maybe you don't want this data to be exposed. That's perfectly fine. But for the purposes of this class, it's certainly very useful. Let's see. So I already talked about, so there's other ways that you can organize all of your photos. If you don't like it, it's my way or the highway, right? Now, the one thing that I want to mention and I want to stress above everything else is that you must please, please back up your files. Please back up all of the photos that you take. And I am dead serious about this. Hard drives fail. They spin 7,000 times or 5,000 times every single minute. How do you not think that something is going to go wrong at some point with the hard drive that is sitting inside of your computer? So please back up. And it is not sufficient, I'm going to say, to buy one external hard drive and back it up only once, because I have had my hard drive fail and then half an hour later my backup hard drive fail. So I have lost photos because even though I was backing stuff up, my both hard drives happened to fail at the same time. And it was enormous bad luck, but I have certainly learned my lesson. I now have my photos backed up. Not only, so I have my photos on the main hard drive, I also have it backed up on another hard drive. I also have it backed up on an external RAID system. I also have it backed up on a server here on Harvard. So I have my photos backed up 4 times, and I am still nervous about it. I really am, because what if Hurricane Earl was a bigger hurricane for us here in the Northeast and it wiped out all of Cambridge? Well, my photos would be gone. And this is something that's very important, not only to back up your files locally, because maybe you will do, and trust me, because I just did this yesterday, eventually, even if you know what you're doing, you could do something enormously stupid and accidentally delete a file and not be able to recover it. And it's not enough to just have one simple backup, because if you delete that file and you have one of those automated backup systems, sometimes that automated backup system will get rid of the file that you've deleted, if you know what I mean. So it only keeps a backup of what you currently have on your hard drive. That's not really enough either. You need to have not only historical backups, so backups that also go back a little bit in time, but also backups that are in different geographical locations in case something horrible happens to your computer. Let's say you have a fire or flood in your apartment or house. It doesn't matter how many backups you have, your photos will burn to the ground, and you don't want to be in that situation. It will be bad enough. You will want to preserve your photos. So please, please, please back up. Now, last year, I actually had an email from a student that was actually a pretty brilliant suggestion, I thought. And he suggested to buy two of these types of external hard drives. And you can buy external hard drives relatively cheap these days. If you're not comfortable buying online, you can just go to Best Buy or to Micro Center, any of those types of places. Buy an external hard drive with enough capacity to store all of your photos, back up all of your photos onto it. And what you do is you buy two of them. You rotate. So you get one, you back up all of your photos, and you take this hard drive and you put it in a safety deposit box in the bank. And I thought this was a good idea. And then the other one, you keep connected to your computer and you back up. You just do a continuous live backup that way, so that you always have a readily available backup. Then in a week or in a month or something like that, you swap hard drives. So you take the one connected to your computer, you take it to the one over in the bank, and you bring back that one over there. And that way, you just are sure that you have a relatively recent backup in another location of all of your photos. Should something horribly bad happen to your computer or to your apartment or to your home, you will be able to at least recover not only your photos, but this goes also for the data on your computer, because increasingly these days, do we store very, very important information like tax documents, all sorts of really important financial information on our computers, and it's useful, if not essential, to have backups of all of this information as well. So you could archive your photos different ways. You could do external hard drives. You could go the really painful routes of writing a lot of CDs and DVDs. Do you remember back in the day, those older computers, whenever you would have to install some software and it was all on floppies, you would get a stack of floppies this high, you'd have to do one floppy after another. Doing it onto CDs or DVDs would be sort of akin to that, but at least you would have a backup. And I'm pretty sure that most of your computers would be able to write to CDs or to DVDs as well. And another thing you could do is you could print your photos as well if you wanted to go old school and actually have an actual film archive. That is a little bit more difficult, I would say, because you would have to then be very careful about controlling the environment that all of these archival prints are stored. It's important to make sure that the humidity is right, that it's dark, that the temperature is cool. That seems like a lot of work to me. So instead, I would suggest having lots and lots of backups. Overcompensate with backups. So however much money you spend on your computer, buy twice that much in backup stuff. And I'm sure most of you will go home and be like, I know that I will also get an email from somebody that says, what happens if I accidentally lose something? I'm telling you now, please, please, please back up your information. Okay, with that in mind, when we come back, after a five-minute break, we will continue talking about software tools. Welcome back, everybody. So before the break, we were talking about software tools. And now for just a little bit after the break, we will as well, before we start actually going into some of what I think is the most interesting aspects and perhaps let's see. So the next two lectures, I think, will give you the biggest enhancement to your photographic skills, because you will thoroughly understand exposure and what it means and what all the values mean. And we'll start talking about that in just a little while. But before, we have just a little bit more to talk about with regards to software tools, and that is that a lot of these software packages actually have the capability of interacting with the camera directly. So you can actually connect your camera to your computer, and you can use some software like Aperture or Lightroom or Phase 1, Capture One, to be able to actually control the camera from your computer. And I think it's neat, but I think it has some limited uses. So some of the uses that you might use it for are when there is a lunar eclipse going on, but it's at the same time as the 2004 World Series, and you really don't want to miss the 2004 World Series, and you really don't want to miss the lunar eclipse. So what you do is you set your camera and your computer in the cold October night outside, and you just let the computer take photos for you. I think that's one of those times where it's totally legitimate to allow the computer to take over the camera. Now, this is actually the result of that exact scenario, is that I set my camera and computer outside, and I had some software that had what's called intervalometer capabilities. And an intervalometer is not specific just to computers. You can also get it for cameras. And what this means is that it will tell, it is basically a remote that will tell the camera to take a photo every minute or every 2 minutes based on an interval that you can specify. And this is very useful and very interesting so that you can take a series of photos like this without actually having to be there the entire time. And it's difficult to see. I did fix the contrast hopefully a little bit, but it's still difficult to see here. But there is actually, this is actually basically composed of multiple frames, but there is a frame, there's sort of two overlapping frames that look sort of like this. And so halfway through, I did have to, you know, leave the watching experience and recompose the camera so that it would continue taking the photos. But using this software is, I think, interesting and useful for certain scenarios. And other times that it might be useful or interesting is when you have a studio-like setup. So if you are taking a lot of commercial-like shots, or you have a little light table set up and you're trying to get a very specific shot and you're trying to look at it on your computer as you're taking the photos, this might be another reason why you might use the same capability, is that you can actually see the photo directly out of the camera as it is taken, pretty much as soon as it is taken. It just has to download onto your computer. And this, I think, is useful and interesting just because using the screen on the back of the camera, although, you know, modern ones are relatively big, you just can't get a sense for the photo and all of its detail as you can on a much larger computer screen. And so this might be a useful thing for you to attempt. And I think there's now even software, even though it's extremely convoluted, I think there's even like an iPhone app that you can download that will then interact with the computer that is then connected to the camera. It's stupidly convoluted, but you could then have it set up so that you can fire your camera remotely with your iPhone. And that also seems kind of interesting, because then you could just be even farther from your camera, even more disconnected from the actual picture taking process that you would be normally. So let's see. So studio setup, that's another reason why you might do that. It's fun and sort of cool, I think, the first couple times that you try it. Some cameras also let you connect it to more than just a computer, so you can have one wire running to your computer, and then some also have like little HDMI, and an HDMI connection allows you to connect the camera to an HDTV, so you can not only download the file from your camera onto your computer, but you can also see on your massive living room TV the photo that you had just taken. That's also kind of neat as well, I think, especially for the same sort of studio setup. Now, moving on, some of the primary reasons that we will use software tools in the class this semester is for raw processing. And that is where you will take a photo in the raw file formats, you will download it to your computer, and you'll just have to do some light processing on it. And the reason that you have to process a raw file is that they're all pretty much all incompatible with each other. The raw file from my camera will be different from the raw file in your camera unless you happen to have the same model. So we have to sort of standardize, and it's very much along these lines of taking your film, your negative, to a dark room and processing it. You have to do some processing on a raw file to be able to send it to other people on the internet or to your friends and family. Do you have a question?
When you say light processing, do you mean like gentle, easy, small amounts of manipulation, or like somehow manipulating the light photo?
We are going to be doing both. We are going to be doing some literal light manipulation where you can actually modify very slightly the exposure in an image. And we will also be doing some heavy modification where you will actually use some software package like Photoshop and do some masking capabilities or some very large modification to an image itself. We will be doing both, but at least initially, for the first assignments, I think you do no modifications, and then slowly we start building up the modifications that you actually perform on an image. So it's both. We do all sorts of modifications to these, mostly later on. Now, it used to be that I could stand up here and say, oh, this is fantastic. You'll be able to use Adobe Photoshop and Adobe Raw, Adobe Camera Raw, to be able to download or to be able to modify and process your raw photos. But the problem is that literally days before the class started, Adobe seems to have sort of pulled the rug out from under FAS, and they changed the license slightly. The effect is that you can no longer, as students, unfortunately, download Photoshop and use it for the duration of this class. It used to be the case where that was true. If you take it, if you took it before, you would actually be able to use it, and it was annoying because you had to download, first of all, this big file, and you had to jump through some hoops to be able to use it on your home computer, but it was doable. Now, unfortunately, it seems that we have lost that option. So we're going to be doing a little bit of scrambling and trying to determine what we will do, but hopefully you will still be exposed to at least some Photoshop and be able to use it, because it is the de facto standard for modifying images, and it's definitely an interesting it's an interesting way of modifying your images, and we hope to be able to introduce that. But we do have that little niggle that we'll have to try to work through a little bit later. Luckily now, you don't have to work with Photoshop quite yet, so we are okay. Now, a lot of these things that you see here, for example, the histogram up top, we will actually be discussing, of course, at a later date, but all of these things you will be familiar with by the time we start working with these with Photoshop. Now, one of the best uses and perhaps most common uses for the software tools, besides actually using raw processing, will be to resize and to crop your images. And it's surprising, I think, that there's a whole bunch of reasons why you would want to resize and crop, and I'm a little surprised at just the prevalence of it seems that people have difficulty with this, is what I'm trying to say. And I'm not really sure why. There's two ideas here, resizing and cropping, and they're very, very different, even though you might say that the end result is kind of the same, but don't get confused. Resizing is when you take an image that's this big and you shrink it to be this big. And usually, you don't go the other way. Usually, you don't take an image that's this big and make it bigger like this. And the reason for that is you are just throwing away data. You're just creating data when before there was none, and there's not really a reason to do that. And along these same lines, digital zoom, if your camera has digital zoom, turn that crap off as quickly as you can. It is the most useless feature that is purely marketing that any camera has. And the reason for this is that all it does is it does both a combination. It does not only a crop, but it also does a resize. And doing a crop is basically when you just take a portion of the image like this and you crop it out. So the difference is that we could have an image that's this big and we've taken it out of that portion of the image, so we only see the lower right-hand corner, or we could have taken this entire image and resized it down. Hopefully the difference makes sense. Now, when coming back to this idea of digital zoom, they do both. They crop the center of the frame, so it only takes the center 50% of the pixels or what have you, and it blows it up. It just zooms in and it resizes it to make it the final image size that your camera originally had. And this is really, really silly because your camera has no more resolution than its sensor is capable of. When you actually look at the raw pixels, they are square. And the more you zoom in, the more squarer they become. And if you use digital zoom and you just use it to artificially inflate that, they have some tricks, but it's not like the CSI style, enhance image, and suddenly there. And I think somebody told me they literally saw a show where there was a surveillance footage of somebody that was, you know, robbing a bank or something like that, and they, you know, surveillance footage is not very high resolution to begin with, and what they said is, okay, let's zoom in on their face and enhance, and of course they, you know, the face shows perfectly clear, and then they said, okay, oh, look, there's somebody in the reflection of the eye. So they zoom into the eye, they enhance the reflection, and they can identify that person. Give me a break. This eye is like 1 or 2 pixels large at the most. There's no way you're going to be able to get data from that. So forget all of your illusions about this digital enhancement. It's crap. It's not going to work. There are reports, there's even some really neat research online that claims to be able to do this, that claims that they have found the CSI style enhance, But it's not the same thing. And the reason is that it still requires, I really didn't want to get into the technical reason, but basically they're able to take a random sampling of pixels and fill in the remainder. It doesn't mean that they're able to enhance the image, it just means that they're able to take an image that has some pixels missing and fill them in. It's not the same thing at all. So this enhancement is bogus. You will not be able to enhance an image, and along those lines, this digital zoom is not going to give you a very high quality enhancement or a very high quality zoom. Instead, what I would suggest is turn off digital zoom, use your optical zoom the best you can, and later on crop it yourself. Because usually when you use computers, when you use software on your computer versus when you use it on your camera, you'll get a better quality zoom or a better quality crop and resize than if you were to actually do it. But I think it's silly in the end to actually just resize an image to be larger than it was, unless you have a very good reason to do so. It's just not going to work as well as you would hope. Okay, so with that rant over, resizing and cropping is very, very useful. Now, one thing that I should mention about resizing is that you will typically, when you're resizing, you want to preserve what's called the aspect ratio of the image. The aspect ratio is the number of is the ratio of the number of pixels across by the number of pixels down. So, for example, you might think of older TVs, the older style, you know, big CRT TVs, how they were sort of squarish, versus the newer HD TVs, which are more rectangular. Those TVs have a different aspect ratio. The ratio of the width to the height is slightly different. And when you resize an image, you want to preserve that ratio. Because if you don't, let's say you just squish an image down this way, you're not preserving the aspect ratio, so now everybody's going to look a little bit wider. Or if you squish an image this way, everybody will look a little bit taller and a little bit thinner. And that's typically not what you want to do. Maybe you do, but typically not what you actually want to do in an image. So usually when you're resizing, you want to modify the image you want to resize the image the same amount in width as height. And that's not... Let's see, so you have to maintain the ratio. So usually this is a little checkbox that says preserve proportions, preserve aspect ratio, or something like that. All of these options are basically the same thing that allow you to make sure that you can resize an image without having to resort to squashing it. So let's see, I think hopefully I'll be able to do this. Now on this particular program, I can use this adjust size. And we can see that what it is giving me is the default width and height. So we can see that it's about 2600 pixels wide by about 1700 pixels down. And if we actually divided this, if we found the actual aspect ratio, we found that there's about 3 pixels across for about every 2 pixels down. So it's an aspect ratio of about 3:2, or it's probably exactly 3:2. And most digital SLRs have this aspect ratio because it is a common aspect ratio for digital SLRs. Many compact cameras have an aspect ratio that's much closer to the older style TVs, 4:3. So that's a much more square in shape, but it is a typical aspect ratio that you would find in not only in computer screens. So this computer screen, for example, has an aspect ratio of 4:3, but also older TVs, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, now, with that in mind, you will see that I have this little checkbox here, scale proportionately. This is the same thing that I was referring to before. This means that I can modify the width of this image from 2592, because that is a lot of pixels. If I'm sending this picture to my mom, that's going to inundate her with pixels. Maybe I will scale it to a much more reasonable 800, or maybe even 1024 pixels across, and you'll notice that correspondingly it modifies the height of the image to maintain the aspect ratio here. If I had this unchecked, scale proportionately, then I would be resizing the image, but I would be modifying the aspect ratio at the same time, and this is not what I want. So rather than 1024, let's say I went to something like a square aspect ratio, 683, this will have what result when I hit enter? Yeah, it will change the way the photo looks, but it will appear to be taller and skinnier, but the photo in the end will be much smaller than it is now. It will be square, and the contents of the photo will appear to be taller and skinnier because I've squished it this way, right? So if I hit enter on this, resample image, basically just says that it's not a, it's just a fancy way of saying to do a better quality resize than it would without that checked. But unless you know what you're doing, resampling is perfectly fine. So we hit OK, and we can see that now it is taller and skinnier than it was before, and it is much smaller. So undo, and now it's the original aspect ratio there. Okay, so typically when you are resizing, if you're emailing an image, not if you are posting to Flickr, because we need pretty much our original resolution images unless you're told to resize otherwise. But usually if you're emailing them, a good size to start with is a 1024 width, about 1,000 pixels across, or about 800 pixels across is a good width to start with. If you're posting them on the internet, now there's a lot of variance here, I would say, but at least that big, I think, is a good beginning point. If it's too small, then people really can't see the details, can't really appreciate your image. But if it's too big, then you'll just be inundating them with pixels, and you know your poor family, whoever it is that's looking at your photo, who's less knowledgeable about computers, might say, "Oh, that's nice, dear, but I only see a little light streak across the page. It doesn't make any sense to me." So having a resized image will make that much more successful for you. Okay, any questions on that? Now, when you crop, maintaining an aspect ratio isn't necessarily quite as important because you're not resizing the image. If you crop at a different aspect ratio, that's okay. You're not going to be squishing anything, right? If that makes sense, because we could crop this bar out of the image and we would just have a ridiculously wide aspect ratio, but we haven't squished anything within this image. So it's important to realize that when we're talking about aspect ratio, we're usually talking about it in combination with resizing an image. Okay, now, very, very quickly, when we're talking about photoshopping an image, and by the way, last year I ran into this this web page from Adobe. You know, Adobe is the creator of Photoshop, and they so passively aggressively have said very explicitly that Photoshop is not a verb, and they give you very explicit instructions about the proper use of Photoshop and how, or you know, the word Photoshop and how you're allowed to say it and how you should not say it. And it went so far as to say, people might say this image looks Photoshopped. And they said, oh no, that's the, and then they say, okay, no, this is not how you're supposed to say it. This is how you should say it instead. This image looks as though it has been modified with Adobe registered trademark, Photoshop trademark, little symbol. And they actually wrote the little symbols in there. And I understand what they're doing. I understand that they're trying to protect their trademark, that they're trying to protect the brand name, but it went a little bit too far. And so as a result, I use the verb more now. So anyway, whenever we Photoshop images, take that, Adobe. Whenever we Photoshop images, we do have to take into account the sort of the ethics of it. And this applies much more, I would say, to photojournalistic images or to images that represent themselves as being accurate of something, of the scene, or whatever it is that they've taken a photo of, that modifying an image with Photoshop or with other image manipulation software is of questionable morality or ethics, rather. And this image here, this is actually a Photoshopped image on Time Magazine, where somebody took this photo of President Reagan and they actually added the tear at a later point in time. And people, this actually brought up a question. Is this a reasonable use of Photoshop? Is this a proper modification? And, you know, it is what it is. You can say what you want about it, but they did give credit. They did say in with the credits in this magazine that the image was modified. And that, I think, is a little bit more credible than just providing it and saying, oh, this image is original and this is how this image always looked. And in fact, there are a couple of instances when this has actually become quite a problem. So, for example, there is an image that was passed around and was posted on a couple of front pages on newspapers a couple of years ago. This was back in July of 2008. And this image, they found, was heavily Photoshopped. But this image appeared on the very front page of the LA Times, the Palm Beach Post, the Chicago Tribune. Most of these are pretty name brand, pretty big names newspapers. And this was, of course, when newspapers were still relevant, unfortunately. But nowadays, this is still important, especially online, especially in print. If you take an image that looks like this, and you can tell it is photoshopped, that it has been modified in some way, because there are a couple of sets of there are a couple of things that have been highlighted here that are exactly the same, pixel for pixel. The smoke that occurs here is exactly the same. This that missile itself is the same as the missile on the left, and they actually did some digging, and they found that the original image looked like this. There were not four missiles that were fired, there were only three. And this was a misrepresentation of the scene. This, even though it was relatively minor, you might argue, this is not the what was represented in the scene. And far worse things, people have been fired, frankly, for far worse things. National Geographic, for example, was it National Geographic? No, maybe it's not National Geographic. There was some photographer that took a photo of a fireman in front of a sun, and it was a really neat image because it was, you know, the fireman was in silhouette, and you could see like the water stream that he was spraying onto a burning house or what have you. And this photographer actually just increased the saturation. He just made the background look a little bit more orange to give it a little bit more pop, a little bit more color. And they found out that this was not the original representation of the scene, that it was not the original image, and they fired him. And perhaps rightfully so, because he represented it as being from the scene, and this is not what was there. And in fact, there are instances throughout history of photoshopping, or even just manipulation of the photo in any number of ways that stretches as far back since the beginning of photography itself. So around 1860, there is this portrait of U.S. President Abraham Lincoln. And this picture is not actually of Abraham Lincoln. It is his head posted on somebody else's body, John Calhoun's body. And if you actually take a look at the original image, and you might have seen this photo before. You might have seen it in a history textbook or online or what have you, but it is not an accurate representation of Lincoln because it is not his body. It is him, his head posted on somebody else. And how many times have you looked at a photo and you would say, I really should put somebody else's face on this body? They've been doing this now for a very, very long time. And there's this, I'll post again a link to this because it's really fascinating to go through and look at this. Let's see. There's another one that was pretty interesting. No, that's not it. Let's see, maybe it's the early 1900s. Oh, yeah, so Stalin routinely airbrushed his enemies out of photographs. So in this one, for example, he realized that he didn't like this guy, so he was airbrushed out. And in fact, you can kind of see it a little bit. Like, you can see that this railing doesn't quite look right where the original person used to be. And this was what in nowadays we would just call a bad photoshopping job, and they had bad darkroom jobs back then too. They took somebody out, and let's see, was there another interesting one? Oh yeah, I love this one. All right, so to create a heroic portrait of himself, Benito Mussolini had the horse, the horse handler removed from the original photograph. Yeah, it speaks for itself, I think. It's humorous, but this is something that has been going on for many, many years. And nowadays, we see all sorts of stuff that are photoshopped, airbrushed, modified in some way that really bring out the implications of our modification of these photographs. And so this is a question that you'll have to answer for yourself. What is an acceptable change to a photograph? And for me, like what I said before, if a photograph is supposed to represent a scene, if it's claimed to be original and accurate, I think it should not be modified in any way. But otherwise, you might as well have some fun with it. You might as well do some artistic work with that image just a little bit, maybe to enhance it. And in fact, this image is not an original image. It is a composite of two, even though they're very, very similar. It just adds some additional lights to the road. And the reason for this was that at 8 p.m. on Raton Pass, there's not many cars. And no matter how long you have your shutter open, you're just going to capture one or two cars. So if you want to make a slightly more convincing or a slightly more interesting photograph, you might have to composite a couple of images together. So I freely admit that this image has been photoshopped. But I also don't claim that this was, this is exactly what the scene looked like at that particular time. It sort of did, but, you know, there's more cars than were present at any one moment in time in that image to begin with. Now, there's lots of neat and fun tutorials for Photoshop online. One of my favorite, even though it's really just sort of a comedy series, is called You Suck at Photoshop. And it's really funny, and I highly recommend it. And after you watch it, hopefully you'll be able to use more than just $20 worth of the $600 of Photoshop that you could actually pay for. So it's a funny thing. We don't have time to show any of them, but it's something that you might take a look at and find interesting or humorous. Though, if I recall, he uses some non-PG words, so be prepared for that if you are sensitive to those particular kinds of things. Now, Photoshop is all fun and good, and it's very interesting. We will be talking about how we can modify images with Photoshop at a later date. But before we can get to all of that, we actually first have to start taking some photographs. And for us to be able to do that, we have to kind of start at the beginning. And I know what you're thinking. Oh, my God, why are you showing me this crap? This is high school physics. I don't want to see this. But this is very, very, very important. And there's not very many takeaways take away from this. And in order for us to talk about how a camera captures a scene, we have to realize that all it's doing is capturing light. And so for us to talk about light, we have to break it down just a little bit, just talk about a teensy amount of high school level physics. And that is that light basically just has the properties of both waves and particles. Now, we have seen, or hopefully you have seen this before, where this is the electromagnetic spectrum. And this is the spectrum of electromagnetism at different frequencies. And for us, when we view light, we are looking at these particles that are called photons that have light in itself has the properties of both particles, photons, and this sort of wave-like property. So what we are looking at when we see things in light is we are looking at a very narrow range of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's this small range that produces all of the colors that we can see. And you can see that it belongs to the much larger spectrum of electromagnetism up there, where much longer wavelengths we get into the infrared, much shorter wavelengths we get into the ultraviolet, and those we can't see. But what we do see is this range of light from wavelengths of, about 400 nanometers all the way up to about 700. And light, as you know, it moves very, very quickly. But because of this, so this is how the wavelength is related to its frequency. It depends on its speed, but we don't have to worry about that. What is important is that we can see these colors out of this electromagnetic spectrum. And the light that we see is made up of these particles called photons. And the more photons that we see, that we perceive, the brighter a scene looks. And in fact, this is very much a very quantized thing. So in other words, when we have one photon, if we have another photon right next to it, we might consider that to be double the amount of light. So every time that we double the number of photons, we're doubling the amount of light that we see, or rather the brightness of the light that we perceive. Now, it's a little bit silly, because our eyes actually don't perceive light very linearly like that. Every time there's a doubling in the number of light, our eyes will actually play some tricks on us, and more specifically, our brains will play some tricks on us. But this is very important when we're talking about photography. So doubling the amount of photons doubles the brightness of a scene, or having the number of photons halves the brightness of a scene. And interesting sort of side note here. Now, this visible spectrum, you might be wondering, well, why can we see only this narrow band of the electromagnetic range? Why not something higher up in the microwave range, or maybe something with increasing frequency like in the gamma rays? Why do we see this visible spectrum? Well, there's this concept of something called black body radiation. It's basically the radiation that an object in space will give off. And our sun gives off radiation, as you know. And it sort of follows this peak-like format where if we actually were to graph the radiation, the electromagnetic radiation that our sun gives out, it looks sort of like this, sort of like a bell curve. And if this is frequency, what we can see actually corresponds to the highest output of radiation from the sun. So what we perceive up here, this is actually the highest output from the sun. And this is not by accident. This is, you know, through evolution, our eyes have been tuned to be most sensitive to the radiation that the sun gives out in its highest quantity, if that makes sense. So there's a very specific reason why we see this band in the electromagnetic spectrum, and that is because of the radiation that our sun gives out. Now, there's one more interesting thing about light. Because it behaves also like waves, these waves can have different directions. So, for example, we might see a wave that goes in this direction, and we might have a wave that actually goes in, because it's 3D, could go in this direction, so in a horizontal versus a vertical direction. And this is normally when we see light from the sun, for example, it comes in all sorts of directions, so diagonally, horizontally, vertically, all sorts of directions. But sometimes we need to do something called polarize this light. And you might have some polarized sunglasses, you might have a polarizing filter in front of your camera. All this means is that it blocks certain directions of that wave travel. So for example, a polarizing filter might be arranged like this so that any waves that try to pass through it in this direction just cannot, but waves that pass through it in this direction will follow through these polarizing slits, as you can think of them. And so that is something that we will, of course, come back to at a later time. Now, you don't have to know any anatomy, but it's interesting to make the comparison between how our eyes perceive light, how we perceive light, to how computers do it, or rather, how cameras do it as well. So light comes in through the iris, it's focused by the lens, and in the end it is projected to the back of the eye, to the back of the retina, where we have basically sensors. We have cells that detect the light that has been focused by the lens in our eye. So it's pretty interesting. We have at the very back of the retina something called the macula. The macula is a higher concentration of cells that can view stuff. And within this macula, we have something called the fovea. And the fovea is actually where we get the vast majority of our central vision. It's where we get the detail in our vision and the majority of our color vision. We'll talk about this again just a couple slides. The optic nerve, just to show you some more interesting things. The optic nerve, of course, comes from the brain, and you see where it attaches to the back of the retina here. There are no cells. There are no optic cells at the very front of this optic nerve where it connects to the retina. So you actually have a blind spot in your eye. We all have it, even though we don't perceive it. There is a spot about right here for all of us where you cannot see something that is right there. And in fact, our brain just fills it in with sort of a faux Photoshop sort of moment where it just fills in some additional surrounding color so that it looks like we have a full field of vision, but you don't. And every time I see people doing like this, like changing, like turning their eyes, of course you can't turn your eyes to do this. When we start, we will talk about some optical, oh my gosh, what are they called? Optical illusions. But it's really fun if you look online for some of these optic nerve or these blind spots, little testers, you will be able to find out that usually on like a computer, there's a way you can test for this. They show you two dots. They tell you to focus your eyes on one dot, and then the other dot just disappears. It's that sort of thing that I'm talking about here. So this is very similar in spirit to a way a camera works, because light comes in, it's focused into the back of this light capturing device, and this light capturing device accepts the light and processes it in some way. So just another look. Again, you don't actually have to know anatomy, but this is just an interesting look of how our eyes function. This is now a more top-down view of our eye. So again, you can see the lens. The iris of our eye, this is going to be very interesting because, as you know, the iris of our eye either closes or opens depending on the light situation. In a very similar way that the iris or the aperture of a lens will actually do the same. So there's another comparison to be made there. And we have here the fovea, which is the high concentration of cells, the optic nerve where we have no optical cells. Let's see. So the fovea is actually a very small part. It's about 1 millimeter in diameter. And in the center of that, there's something called the foveola, where we have an even higher concentration of color cells. And now we have a couple of different types of cells in our eyes. We have the rods and the cones. And most of you have probably heard of these before, but it is interesting to talk about the differentiation between the two. So rods, for example, give us night vision. They are what are activated when we go outside and it's really dark, we can't see anything, and after a while we start to be able to see things. That is the rods in our eyes giving us the night vision. Whereas the cones are better suited, they are not quite as sensitive, you might say, so they're better suited for brighter light, where they don't have to be as sensitive to the light to be able to view what is going on. So, like I just said, night vision means that they're more sensitive to light, whereas day vision means that it is less sensitive to light. The rods, they're not in the fovea, really, but you will find the cones concentrated in the fovea. And in fact, if you have an astronomer friend, they might always tell you, whenever you are stargazing outside, never look directly at the thing that you are trying to look at. The reason for that is this right here, because we have no rods in our fovea, in the very center of our vision, which means that we have very poor night vision right in the center of our eye. But as soon as you start, you don't look, you don't divert your eyes, but as soon as you start paying attention to the periphery at night, you will notice that you actually have better vision out of the areas that are not central in your eye. Now, you actually have way more rods than you have cones in your eye, 22 times as many, but that's just because the cones are just not found quite as much outside of the fovea. They're just in much lower concentration. And that's one of the reasons why you have very good central vision. That's why you have very good detailed vision in the very center of where you're looking, and not quite so much on the outside in the periphery. Now, one of the biggest differences between the two, I guess besides all of the rest of this, is that the rods really don't give you any color information. The cones are what are responsible for giving your brain the color information for the scene that you were looking at. So, for example, you see that... I really should have some color on this slide, I guess. Or something. You see that... Oh, man, I've got nothing here, do I? My shirt is red, okay? So if it were much darker in this room, first of all, our camera wouldn't work, but second of all, neither would your cones. And so as a result, your rods would kick in, and the red just does not look as red-like, if that makes sense. You just can't see color as well at night as you can during the day. And the reason for that is because of these cones versus the rods. Now, in the cones, they're actually much better suited to seeing detail. So they can see this sort of high-resolution detail. It's why we can see such high detail in the central of our vision, whereas the rods are not so good at detail, but what they do give us is this ability to detect motion. And that's, again, why we have such good peripheral visions. If something is coming quickly at us from the side, we notice it. And the reason for that is that we have a lot of rod cells that are outside of the center of the fovea, and we can detect motion very easily that way. So what happens if we are born and for some reason we have no rods? What just suggests what might happen? What can happen if we have no rods? Yeah, you can't see it. So you lose your night vision. You have not as good motion detection. You just won't be able to detect motion as much, especially in the periphery. You'll notice that you have much less peripheral vision than you did in the cones. So what happens if you lose cones? What's that?
You get a night job,
yeah. I guess you would have to, and the reason is that you would not be able to see as well during the day. You would lose the ability to see fine detail. You would lose the ability to see color also if you were to do this. So this graph, don't be confused by it. This just shows we have basically different types of cells in our eyes. So if we have not only three different types of cones. So beyond this differentiation where we have rods and cones, we have one type of rod in our eyes. So we have rods, and we have three different types of cones. And these three different cones are optimized to show us, oh my gosh, this is taking forever, to show us different types of color, much in the same way that when you actually look at a camera sensor or a computer screen, how it's divided into red, green, and blue, it's sort of the same thing with our eyes. So we have here, for example, the S type, the M type, and L type cones, which are sensitive to different types of colors. And so this is showing us the wavelengths that these cones are sensitive to. So we can see that over here, we have the violet region of the electromagnetic spectrum. Up here, we have the red spectrum. So for example, our S-type cones are very good at detecting violet and blue and not quite so good at green, yellow, and red. Our M and L types, however, are much better suited to seeing yellow, red, and green than the other types of, or than the LS type of cone. Now, what's interesting is that we actually have a prevalence of M and L types of M and L type cones in our eyes. So although there's wide variation in a population, the average of everybody is that we have something like 95% or something like that ML type cones, and the rest are S type. And this is one reason why we see why the color green appears to be much brighter than the color blue. And again, of course, you know, I'll talk about that later, so on and so forth. Okay, now one of the things that you'll notice that's particularly interesting, one more thing I want to point out, is the dotted line right here. You'll notice that it is not sensitive to the color red. So what this means is that if you have night vision, if you have worked hard, if you sat outside in the dark for 30 minutes and you finally have good night vision and you need to be able to see something, you know, illuminate something with the light, don't destroy your night vision with just white light. White light contains all of this wavelength here, all of the colors in the spectrum, and you will quickly, the rods will be sensitive to it'll realize, okay, there's some light, there's a lot of light in the cyan region, so it will basically just shut down. So your night vision will be destroyed. However, if you have a very, very red light, and again, this is what astronomers will use in a lot of cases, you will see them with like red flashlights or what have you. The reason for that is that the rods are not sensitive to red light, and you will not destroy your night vision. It will not cause the rod cones to shut down, thinking that there is much brighter light. So if you are in a location where you're taking photos and you've worked hard to, you know, you've sat outside for half an hour to get a proper amount of night vision and you want to continue taking photos, but you need to see the settings on your camera or you need to fiddle with something in your bag, make sure you just have some sort of red light handy to ensure that you don't destroy your night vision. Okay, moving on. So the cameras, there's a pretty large similarity to the eye. We can only take this analogy so far, but it is relatively similar in that the light comes in through the lens, it is focused, and is focused onto the back of the eye, or on basically to where we have the sensors, so to speak, our cells, our rods and cones that sense the light for us. Now, just a little while ago, I was talking about how light is quantized, how we have this idea of photons. And every time we double the number of photons, it is twice as bright, in other words. And so this translates in photographic terms to an idea called stops. So we talk about exposure in photographs as it relates to stops. So if one photograph is one stop brighter than another photograph, then in real-world terms, that means that there are twice as many photons in the brighter photograph than there were in the not-as-bright photograph. And this is how we differentiate between one stop to, or how we differentiate between exposure values, is that we talk about stops and we use that interchangeably with this term EV or exposure values. All of these mean the same thing, which basically just means a doubling or a halving of the light. Now recall that I told you that our eyes don't actually perceive things to be twice as bright. When we see something twice as bright, our brains actually play a little bit of a trick on us. So this may not actually look twice as bright. This plus 2 EV may not actually look twice as bright as plus 1 EV, which may not look twice as bright as plus 0 EV, but they are actually a stop difference between each other. So this is a doubling or a halving of the amount of light. Now, something that I do want to point out is that you generally want to get your photographs to within this. You want to get it to about plus zero EV. So in other words, the photo as a whole should be properly exposed. And if it is improperly exposed, if it's overexposed, then that means that it is just far too bright. So this photo is overexposed. It is far too bright given the scenario. And the result of this overexposure is that we have a loss of detail. Notice that we have detail, especially in the people that we just did not have, or that we do not have in this plus two EV photo that we did in the properly exposed photograph. And once you have overexposed the photograph, especially in the digital realm, that data is gone. You are not going to be able to get it back. There's, again, I'm overgeneralizing. We'll talk about this later, so on and so forth. But for the most part, if you have an overexposed image like this, you might as well not even try it. You are not going to be able to get the data back that existed before. Now, underexposure is sort of the same thing. It's sort of the same beast, but in the other direction. It's just too dark. So we could have gone negative 1 EV, negative 2 EV, and that photo would be just far too dark for the scene at hand. And again, we would have a loss of detail there. It would just be too dark for us to see the detail. And even if we tried to make the image brighter, the camera most likely just did not capture the details that were there. Now, we tie all of this together using exposure settings in a camera. There's a certain amount of light in this room. And I have about three settings that I can manipulate on this camera to try to capture the amount of light that is in this room. Now, it's important to realize that a camera's sensor has a very narrow range, relatively, of what it can capture, of what it considers too dark and what it considers too light. So too many photons hitting the sensor will result in this overexposure because the camera is just inundated by brightness. It just cannot capture any more photons. Too little, and we get the opposite. It's too dark. So by modifying these three settings, there's three settings, then we will be able to try to manipulate the amount of photons in the room. And again, we can't create more photons, but we can allow more photons to hit the sensor. Then we will ensure that we are getting the proper amount of photons onto the sensor and get a properly exposed photograph. So one of these settings is shutter speed. And we talked about this briefly, how I said, okay, I have a really long shutter speed on this camera. And what that means is that there's that shutter. If you recall from the videos from last week, there was the shutter that opened once, and then there was a trailing shutter behind it. That shutter is open for a long, long time. This shutter, when I took this pinhole photo, was open for 367 seconds, 6 minutes and 7 seconds. So for 6 minutes, was the shutter open and photons were flowing into the sensor. And the sensor was collecting all of these photons. And in the end result is that after 6 minutes, it had collected enough photons that it would be able to properly expose this. If it was much less time, let's say I had only used 100 seconds, what would happen? It would be too dark. Not enough photons would be collected by the camera, and so it wouldn't be able to show you the detail that existed in the scene. To determine how long of a shutter speed I had to use, I actually had to use some math using another lens. If I had done the calculation incorrectly, and instead I did 700 seconds instead of about 350, then what would happen? It would be overexposed. It would have gotten twice as many photons, and it would have looked like this instead of like this. And so this is an important distinction when we're actually using a camera, is that the shutter speed is very, very important. We must use it to obtain a proper number of photons on the camera. Now, most cameras can't actually take photos for 367 seconds. You can't turn a dial and tell it that you want it for that long. Usually what you have to do is this mode called bulb mode, B-U-L-B. And what this does is it allows you to push and hold the shutter for as long as you want, push and hold the button for as long as you want the shutter open. And as long as you have that button pushed, it will hold the shutter open and you can specify however long of a shutter speed you want. Usually most cameras can't do beyond about 30 seconds. So for 300 seconds, I had to do it myself. Now, you might have noticed that I wasn't standing here like an idiot holding the shutter this entire time. The reason for that was that I had a remote connected, and that remote had a little lock on it, so that I set the lock, and it just constantly held down that button for me. So it was, and then that's why I had the timer. The timer went off, and I turned off the remote, and I got the exposure of 367 seconds. Now, we won't be able to talk about this for much longer, but as a teaser for next week, you can get some really cool effects with having longer shutter speed. Usually when we talk about shutter speed, it's very, very quick. It takes an instantaneous snap of whatever it is we're looking at, but increasing the shutter speed will give you some pretty interesting effects, just like you saw in this other photo as well. So with that, thank you all for coming, and we will see you next week. Yes? Shutter speed, ISO, and F number. F number, aperture. Those are the three settings that we will be talking about in the upcoming weeks.